Inside Books with Breda Brown.
Welcome to Inside Books, a programme about the magical world of writing. I'm Breda Brown, and in each episode of Inside Books, we chat to people associated with the world of books, including well-known authors, publishers, editors, agents, critics, booksellers, and more. You'll find Inside Books on all audio platforms, and our Twitter handle is at InsideBooksIRE, where you'll also find lots of other interesting book news. My guest today is Emer Martin, a Dubliner who has lived in Paris, London, the Middle East, and a variety of locations across the United States. Her first novel was called Breakfast in Babylon. It was published in 1995 and went on to win Book of the Year at Listowel Writers Week. Her latest book is her fifth, and it's called Thirsty Ghosts. Interestingly, it's the second in a planned trilogy. The first book in that trilogy was called The Cruelty Men and was shortlisted for the Kerry Group Irish Novel of the Year in 2019. Emer has also written a number of children's books, and she's an artist who has had a host of sellout shows. She's a BA in English and Fine Arts, a Master of Fine Arts in Cinema. She taught writing in Trinity College for a while and now lives in California, where she teaches English and journalism. Well, that's a nomadic lifestyle, isn't it?
Yeah, I think I've always been restless. I haven't finished yet as well.
Oh, really? Okay, we'll come back to that.
I've been 10 years where I am, so I'm going, that's a lot. That's a long time.
It's time to go to the
next
destination.
Yeah, I'm getting itchy feet.
Well, you got itchy feet, you've said, when you were 17, because you fled Ireland, you've mentioned at some point. You know, that's sort of quite a strong emotion. Why did you want to leave?
Well, the Ireland where I was growing up in was the Ireland of the 80s, which would be unrecognisable to anybody in secondary school now. It was a really parochial, repressive place, the church. I had a few run-ins with the priest and the nuns. You know, we were all kind of in convent schools. The church really dominated life, and for girls, I remember you were kind of somewhat meant to go to college, but really find a good man in college. And it still was all of that. And I remember my sister went back for her school reunion, and she said, they were all talking about that, how nothing was expected of them. Now, they overachieved and they went on to do great things, but it wasn't expected as a woman. So really. And I remember Dublin was so small and depressing. Like, we didn't have Temple Bar. That was just sort of the buses parked there. Then there were bushes grown out of the building on O'Connell Street. I remember walking down and pointing to my friend Francis and saying, look at the bushes grown out of the building. This is not the Champs-Élysées. So I was itching to get out. I'd a sense the world was elsewhere.
And did you find it when you went elsewhere?
Well, I had this dream. You know, I had this dream. I was reading about Hemingway and all of the people are sitting around in Paris cafes, and the existentialists and Joyce and Beckett and all of those. And so I thought there I would be in Paris cafes, you know, talking philosophy and writing books. But instead I ended up au pairing, and it wasn't as glamorous.
The Irish dream.
It was the Irish dream. It was smashed. And I drifted over to London, where I was packing shelves in the Sainsbury's on the down in London East End. And a quick reality check that it takes money to sit around in cafes, and I didn't have it. So then I had a job working in as receptionist in Scotland Yard.
Oh, wow. Interesting.
In the civil service club. Yes. So and also I was seeing how the Irish were viewed there. It was late 80s. So then I hightailed it off, met some Australians who said, why don't you go to Israel and work on a kibbutz? You don't have to have money to go there. So I ended up in Israel, and that was another awakening. I hadn't a clue. So I just sort of used to bounce like that. Then I went off to Egypt for a while and up to Amsterdam and worked on barges there and just kept going around. I was wanting to see more and more. Wherever I was, I wanted the next place.
And when did you start writing then?
I was always writing as I went along. Like, I kept notebooks and I was a great reader. Like, I just devoured books and wherever. I used to find books on buses and ferries and so read random books. Read very widely. Of when you're travelling, you read books left by other travellers. But so it was an eclectic reading. But then living in Paris, I'd go to Shakespeare and Company all the time and devoured everything there. So as always, you know, I was being Irish. I guess the people I saw who escaped even within Ireland were the writers who got to be live outside the norm of a very sort of stultifying society as it was then.
Is that the dream you were chasing then?
I was. I didn't want just that normal life that was sort of laid out before us of finish secondary school, go to college, get a job, settle down, get married, all of that. That seemed very boring to me.
Well, you certainly achieved that.
I did.
So obviously then the travelling and the wide reading had a huge influence then on your writing.
It did. It did. And so I'd keep notebooks, but since I was so nomadic, I used to just throw them all away. So I'd write notebooks, I'd throw them, write notebooks, throw them. But I look back and think maybe it was just like being a violinist and just practicing my scales, all that writing. So God knows what was in those notebooks.
And how did the first book form then?
Well, I was in New York then. And I just wanted to write the stories of the people I'd met in the squats in London and Paris. And there were all these colourful characters I'd met and every one of them had a great story themselves. So I wanted to write about that lifestyle. And it was a lifestyle. Like there were a lot of, I'd bumped in Paris to a whole bunch of lads from Portmarnock and hung out with them. And there was a whole bunch of Irish over there. And we were all sort of the black sheep of our families and escaping. And it wasn't a world where there was any connection or social media. So you could do that, you know. You could bunk across trains and live in squats and really live off the grid in a way I don't see anybody could do now, except if they were very intentional. It'd be almost pretentious to do that now. But we could do it very easily then, really.
And how did you get the book published then?
So I was in New York and I remember writing Breakfast in Babylon and somebody said, you have to get an agent. So I went and got a very big book in the bookshop of agents and sent it off to maybe 67 agents who I marked off in this huge tome.
67.
Yes.
I love it.
And I got 67 rejections. If I was lucky, they rejected me.
Right.
Mostly it was just deafening silence. So I was a bit stunned going, I thought this was it. I thought the book was done. So I sent it off to Ireland, Wolfhound Press, and a writer, Niall Quinn, read it. And he just loved it and wrote me a big letter. And so Wolfhound Press were my first foray into publishing up there in Gardner Street. They were a small Irish publisher. And then Breakfast in Babylon went on to win Book of the Year. And then the US publishers picked it up. So it did really well over in America. I think it sold 50,000 copies. It was a big hit. And it was the time in the 90s, you know, Irvin Welsh and train spotting was big. So anything about that kind of lifestyle was embraced.
But amazing success for a debut.
It was. So I thought, that's it. That's how life goes in the book world. I've made it. I'll just relax here and just you know, go on. But I never realized how hard publishing is. I think I've published with almost a different publisher every time. So it's a hard road. It's a long road. It's a very different business. And even when I was starting, my agent in New York said there were 27 different publishers in New York. There are 5 now.
Right.
So a lot of
things have changed.
Bertelsmann brought them all up. Everything was congealed and conglomerated, so it just became much harder to be published outside of if you weren't writing exactly what the people in publishing who have a specific taste, because the people in publishing in New York were usually, you know, very smart women who went to Sarah Lawrence College, had trust funds, because you had to have a trust fund to work in publishing in New York. They paid the editors, I think they were paying the editors about $20,000 a year in Manhattan. So really it became a job like if you ever see The Devil Wears Prada. It became that kind of job. You had to have money to do the job. And you also had to be very smart and well educated. So then that lends itself to a certain kind of taste in books, right, from a different kind of world. So,
and how did that sit with you then, considering you wanted to be more untraditional, you know?
Well, how it sat with me was that they stopped publishing me. So then I had to scramble around and get published in other places, which I did down at Brandon Press. I published Baby Zero. And then I was Lilliput took up the Cruelty Men. And I was, that went very well. So they're publishing this kind of a trilogy, but every book can be read by itself. That's my aim, that you could pick up. I want to write them as a set to grapple with something that's bothering me about Irish, and an Irish history, and to, you know, my own investigation into it. But I'd like to think that even when I write the next one, it could be read in any order.
And that's the strand you want to pick up on, and you started with The Cruelty Men, and now in Thirsty Ghosts. It is, you know, about a different Ireland. That time you've spoken about Magdalen laundries, all of that. Why do you feel you need to get that out and onto the page?
Well, I wrote the bulk of this when I was living back in Ireland for 10 years in Meath. And I remember it was the time, it was the early 2000s when all of this began to come to light. They had the Murphy Report and the Ryan Report, and talking about how just women and children were treated in so-called free and independent Ireland. So we were told, you're free now. You've thrown off your colonial shackles for, you know, the 26 counties anyway. But it didn't look like freedom to me. And for a lot of women and children, it wasn't free. And hearing all the stories, it was, you know, it was like Solzhenitsyn's gulag. It was like all of that horrendous stories. Like, I picked up a copy of the Ryan Report and the Murphy Report, and I had to tone it all down for the book because it was relentless. The treatment of women and children in Ireland in the 20th century was abysmal.
Why did you tone it down, though?
Because it would have been actually too much for fiction. That's the level of... nobody'd want to pick up a book that was just relentlessly grim. So that wasn't the whole story. So I wanted to show the... So I have two families. So the Lyons and the O'Connells. And the Lyons are that family that have a very comfortable life in Ireland. After independence, they're picking blackberry. They live in the comfort in County Meath. You know, they'd be kind of based on my father's family. You know, there's... Mother was the local school teacher, and they'd have nights where the guard and the solicitor would come play poker at their house. And they were the inheritors of the New Ireland, you know, the educated professional classes who were doing very well and had a really decent life, a very good life here on the corner of Europe in all that 20th century turmoil. But then there was the other side. There was the side of the poor who are living this parallel life in very grim conditions. And it was really... Like, with the mother and baby homes, if you were middle class, it was terrible. You had to go off and have your baby and it was taken away. But at least you got to come home. For the poor and the working class women, they didn't get to come home. They were put on into laundries and kept their whole lives as slaves, working till the 1990s. So in this book, Thirsty Ghosts, it has the contrast of, you know, the punk rocker standing outside Freebird was going on at the same time there were laundries going on. So the contrast of all that, people were listening to the Sex Pistols and there were women trapped in laundries in Ireland in a different world.
And that's what struck me reading the book as well, because the different chapters have different time frames or whatever. And that was it, like 1980s Dublin. And as you say, on the one hand, you've people trying to be free. And on the other hand, the laundries were working up the road. Like, it's such recent history. We sometimes tend to forget that.
It is. Like, it's within most of our lifetimes. It went on till the 90s, that the industrial schools and the laundries were going on, and the absolute control they had over people's lives. And then people, what struck me when I was reading all the stories and talking to people who were involved, that they weren't believed. So they'd come out and they were telling the story, but nobody was listening. No one wanted to listen. And yeah, and it's the power of who gets to tell the story. So that struck me as well when I was reading history of, you know, there's a lot of history involved in the book as well. And history is usually the powerful, right? The nobles, chieftains against the Queen Elizabeth, and you don't get women, children, the poor and the peasants. The rest of us were just sort of pawns and written out of history. So in a way, fiction is a way I can put them back in again. I can put the people back in who've been written out.
And do you feel you've achieved what you set out to achieve with the book?
Well, you know, I've all these great masterpieces inside my head, but then I ruin them by writing them down. So that's what it feels like. So, yeah, the idea I have for the books, of course, you start writing them and it's an unwieldy, quite drudgerous process at times, and you get lost and then you have to find your way out again. But I was really lucky that I had Sean Farrell, who is the editor at Lilliput, and he was able to unthread a few things for me and tell me when I'd wandered too deeply into the woods. And then I had, when I moved over to California in the middle of all this, I thought I was surrounded just by engineers. And when you say in Silicon Valley you're a writer, they go, oh, what kind of code are you writing? It's like, no, not that kind of writer. Ew. And then they go, are you, yeah, an industrial writer? Are you, you know, they just can't grasp. And I'm saying, no, I get to make things up. And they look horrified. But I found my people. I found a writing group who, I looked up the internet and saw the poet laureate of Santa Clara County, where I was living, was David Perez. And so I contacted him and I said, we went for a pint. And he said, what are you looking for? And I said, a writer's group. We'd meet once a month of writers and critique each other. And you're the poet laureate. You must know writers. And indeed he did. And even better, he knew poets who only wrote very small little poems. And there was me able to foist my massive fiction on them, my page filler. And they did limit me. They said, Emer, 8 pages at a time, please stop.
That will do. And you found that really helpful then in terms of just helping to shape the book?
Oh, that was key. I think it's key for anybody if you're trying to write, because you get lost a bit. And it was key to have the constant feedback and also to have the deadline, because I was also working full time. Rent is very expensive there, so I have to pay my rent. And I had 2 teenagers.
And they need to be fed.
I hate to break it to the people who have toddlers who think it's the most difficult stage. Wrong! Wrong, 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 wrong.
And don't burst their bubble.
I will. It's the most expensive stage. And so I had to get my teenagers through. And so I had to work full time. So the writing group really, really kept me. So 8 pages a month, honestly, that's how I did it. I thought, I have to have those 8 pages every month. That's all they let me, and I'll make them take it. And I did. And over the years, that's how Thirsty Ghosts was written, through that writing group.
And it's amazing. We've had a number of authors on Inside Books who have said that, most recently, actually, Una Mannion. And she and some other writers, including Louise Kennedy, set up their own writing group for exactly that. To somebody to have your back, to be able to tell you when things are good, to be able to tell you when things aren't working. And as you say, it's just so, so helpful.
Oh, it's key. And I think it's key to find people sort of in the same place you are. So all of these people were, you know, known poets and they had books. So sometimes if you'd go to a writing group and if you were the only one published, they'd be trying to be too nice to you. Mm. You know, they'd be a bit in awe, but nobody was in awe in this group. So we were all willing to, you know, criticize when it wasn't going, which is what you needed. Yeah, what I needed.
So Thirsty Ghosts is the second in the trilogy. So what's the story with the third? What's happening there?
Well, okay, I'll tell you about the second and the third. So the thing is, I was, you know, on Newgrange, that old stone, they have the triple spiral. Mm-hmm. And it's the sort of way the ancient people looked at time. That's the way I'm looking at the trilogy, because it's like, I'm not thinking of it as first, second and third. I'm thinking of it as all sort of informing each other.
Interconnected
spirals of time. So, yeah, maybe I'm about to write the first. That's what I mean. And maybe this could be the third. And it depends on how you pick them up. I want people to be able to pick them up in any order. And it will all sort of inform each other, but it doesn't matter which one you pick up first. So the other one, yeah, I have material for it. But now that I'm done, this one, there's going to be more. And I want to take it up I want to take, this one ends in the 80s, kind of 89, when Ireland was a mad shop. If you're probably too young to remember the 80s. But
no, I remember them
yeah,
well.
When I look back on it, we were, what was normal in the 80s, it seems very bizarre now. I mean, you know.
Totally different world. And as you said earlier on, social media and digital has just revolutionized. I don't even know if revolutionize is the right word. It's changed everything.
Could you imagine the memes about Shergar now? I could just see Shergar memes. That's all we'd have is Shergar memes.
And in terms of the writing side of it then, do you do it every day? Do you plot? What way do you approach it?
No, and I wish I did it every day. But as I said, there is no balance. When you have to work full time and have a family, it's just to add on writing into it. It feels almost impossible at times. So without that writing group and those 8 pages and lowering my expectations to, if I just get that, that will build up over the year to enough.
And how long did Thirsty Ghosts take?
Thirsty Ghosts took probably over time, maybe 4 years. Well, I'd finished The Cruelty Men in 2019. So, yeah, from 2019 up to 2023. I was lucky COVID happened. That was great.
It gave you a reason to focus.
Every single writer you talk to, whether they admit it or not, we all secretly love COVID. It's like we just get to go away and everybody leaves us alone.
Although it's funny, we've had some writers who said they found it really hard to write during that time.
Oh,
their creative spirit seemed to be broken, which is interesting. And where did the name come from?
Thirsty Ghosts. Well, it was the idea of, there's a thing in Buddhism, there's a called hungry ghosts, and the hungry ghosts are trapped on the wheel of existence and they've insatiable hunger, and they're usually addicts. And when people get trapped in an addiction cycle so I thought, in Ireland we have thirsty ghosts. There's not a field you could stand in Ireland or a street in Dublin that's not full of ghosts. You know, we're a haunted country, really. And the idea was, when I was reading the history, and it was a lot of the history we weren't really taught, or I wasn't a very good student anyway, but in Dublin, as you're the places we're walking around, they kept heads in spikes because it was the main garrison, and which was a medieval thing to do. So the English put heads and spikes all around as warnings to the local Irish of what happened when you didn't comply with the Pale. So I just imagined where they all were. And there's sort of all wood cuttings of like the English galloping out on their horses, and there's just flanked by heads and spikes. So I started to think of those heads on spikes and having conversations with them. And what would they say, and who were they? And how did they find themselves detached from their bodies and up in spikes? So I had the characters wander around Dublin, being able to see them and have conversations with them.
So we sort of glossed over the bit that you've also written children's books, but I'm assuming in those children's books there were no heads on spikes, right? I'm hoping there weren't. Why did you start writing for children?
You know, my kids were of that age, and I was, you know, surrounded by kids' books and loved kids' books, and a really good kids' book. Honestly, I think there's nothing better than a good kids' book. So I wanted to write, Why Is the Moon Following Me? I met a scientist and an illustrator, and they were trying to write a science book for kids in rhyme. But it's hard for... The scientist was finding that it was hard to write in rhyme and poetry. So I teamed up with her, Susanna Tulak. So she kind of educated me in all the science, and we researched, and we had great fun doing a book. It's about astronomy and how we kind of over the years discovered how the Earth was the center. So that was fun. And then in America, it annoys me that nobody knows the Irish origins of Halloween. They think it's theirs. And I'm like, this is ours. This is Samhain. This is Irish New Year. This is not yours. This is influenced by us. Well, they reclaimed it and they gave us a lot of sugar. They did give us sweets. Well, the sugar. Because I remember going around and we'd get nuts and apples and 2 pence coins. But, Yeah, now we get the sugar. They've sugarized Halloween and brought pumpkins. I guess pumpkins are easier to carve than turnips, so we'll give them that. So I wrote the Pooka about the Irish history of Halloween, that you get taken by the Pooka and brought to the moon. That was it. And then the third book was written. I teach a lot of migrant kids and I see the attitude towards migrants. So there's an underlying message in The Pig Who Danced, which is about to be accepting of migrants to anybody's country and area.
And as you said, you teach English and journalism. How do you find it?
Well, I actually teach teenagers and I love teenagers. They're so extra and fantastic and fun.
Extra is a real teenage word.
It is. They are. I know all the teenage words because of it. I now know. As of last week, heard of Skibbity Toilet and how big that is. That has taken over the internet. So I come back to my kids and they tell me, "You can't say that." And I'm going, "Yeah, but you slay." I just do it to torture them.
Exactly. That's it. What are you working on at the moment then?
Well, I'm going to work on this in this sort of spiral narrative I'm writing. I'm going to go on with my next one will be called Hedrick.
Really? I love the names.
Thank you. Thank you. I like my book names except for one. I thought More Bread or I'll Appear was too long. I thought that was a great name at the time. But it was too long.
Things change,
yes.
And before I let you go, Irving Welch, what, like, is he a friend? You've worked together quite a bit. What's he like?
Yeah, he's a very good friend. He's, Irving, I'd say he's, he lived in Dublin here while I was living in Dublin. And we just hung out all the time together. And I remember him in a nightclub in Dublin over in Temple Bar. And we were standing there and some guy came up to him and said, "Are you Irving Welch? Did you write Trainspotting?" He said, "Yes." And the guy, of course, recited Choose Life, recited that bit and said, "It's my favourite book ever." Irving shook his hand and said, "Thanks, mate." And he went off and Irving turned to me and he said, "Do you know what I liked about that guy?" And I was like, "Yeah, that he was quoting a whole passage of your book. That hasn't happened to me." And he goes, "That he went away."
Oh.
And he liked Dublin because Irish people didn't bother him. They'd come and they might shake his hand, but they wouldn't try and sit down and stall themselves.
Just a quick chat.
And dominate the night or something. Yeah. And he said in other places, people would try to take over and sit down and be part of things. But he said Dublin people just left, would acknowledge or nod and off they'd go. So he found that very comfortable to be here.
So your aim then is to get somebody to come up to you to quote a couple of passages from your book to you.
Yeah, I'd say I'd be waiting quite a while. Unless Danny Boyle makes a film.
Well, look, stranger things have happened. Emer Martin, thank you for joining us here on Inside Books. And you'll find all of Emer's books online or at your local bookshop now. The next episode of Inside Books will be out soon. Just keep an eye on our Twitter feed for details. The handle is @InsideBooksIRE. Inside Books is a Unique Media production with research by Nicola Fitzsimons. And if you'd like to hear other episodes, just search for us on the various audio platforms. And don't forget to leave us a rating or review. I'm Breida Brown. Until next time, keep reading.
Inside Books is a Unique Media production.